The Veritas Radio Network is guaranteed the right to offend, annoy, agitate, shout heresy, and entertain.
You should start programming right now.
Kind of like the cultural sewage served up on Bravo or CMT, only it's on 24 hours a day, except Sundays. When the truth gets you angry and you throw your smartphone, remember, no one is forcing you to listen to the truth on the Veritas Radio Network.
You can't handle the truth.
You're doing that of your own free will. That's what makes this country great and any gay marriage pointless.
That's offensive.
So there isn't much you can do about it, Chowderhead.
I'm trying to think, but nothing happens.
Grab a book, take a vow, and conform your mind to reality. Otherwise, you're just another Judas-inspired Karl Marx wannabe.
And your children will steal your credit card number to buy tickets to the Miley Cyrus Twerkers Ball.
I came in like a wrecking ball.
Are you ready? Let's get it on the Veritas Radio Network's Crusade.
The professor is in. Send your questions for Professor Kevin Kutzman to Constitution@VeritasRadioNetwork.com.
And this is the Constitution Hour with Professor Dr. Kevin Kutzman here on the Crusade Channel, part of the Veritas Radio Network. Radio the way it should be on beautiful fall day. I am your host here in Southeast Louisiana at the Crusade Channel Home Studios. Mike Church. And this is just a reminder that if you missed any of the previous 40 or so episodes of the Constitution Hour, they are all available at VeritasRadioNetwork.com. So why don't we get right down to it and bring the host of the broadcast on, Professor Dr. Kevin Kutzman, who was in his office today at Western Connecticut State University. Good afternoon, Kevin. How are you?
I'm well, Mike. How are you?
I am well. I just won a contest with your colleague and at one of your online teaching outlets, libertyclassroom.com, so we're happy about that.
Yeah, well, I heard that you had barely beaten Julie Borowski, and of course I was happy for you, but I was somewhat sorry for her, so maybe she'll win next year.
Well, she was on my show after the fact, and we talked a little bit about that, and I think that she did very well regardless, but it was a very interesting promotion and contest, and we hope to do it again next year. And of course, for those of you that don't know, Professor Kutzman, I think you were the first. You helped Tom launch Liberty Classroom back in 2012.
I think that's true, yep.
And you still teach Constitution and American History there?
Well, I co-authored or co-taught a course in American Constitutional History with Brian McClanahan.
Mm-hmm.
I do America to 1877 and a couple of other things. So, yeah, you can find me on there.
Okay, fantastic. Well, we are a couple of weeks into the transition process of the Trump administration now. So if you're listening to this in tape delay or in 2017, that means we're in early December 2016 as we're recording this today. And we have some nominations that have actually been announced and accepted. We are still awaiting, though, some key ones, namely the nomination for the Secretary of State position. And I was curious to get your take on this. Are you surprised that Mitt Romney and John Bolton, two very decidedly very infamous neocons, are actually in the running for this?
Well, oh boy. I don't think John Bolton is a neocon in the sense that I don't think he's interested in nation building, but I do think certainly that he's the uber interventionist in the Republican Party outside the neocon camp.
Okay.
And Mitt Romney, well, what is there to say for Mitt Romney? I don't think we have any idea. I think he's kind of the Republican version of Hillary Clinton. I think we don't really have any idea what he thinks. I think he transparently tries to manipulate people.
Mm-hmm.
The classic illustration of this is that as governor of Massachusetts, he pushed through the state judiciary the argument that gay marriage was constitutionally required and was successful in using that ruse to make Massachusetts the first gay marriage state in the country. And then when he was the Republican nominee for president, he sponsored or he advocated a national constitutional amendment mandating that marriage be one man and one woman. So how dumb do we look? I mean, I have often wondered whether Professor Gruber, who of course lives in Massachusetts, had anything to do with that. It seems to me that Romney transparently is one who wants to manipulate people and must have thought, well, evangelical voters, especially in the South, don't much like me, so I'll come out as Mr. Traditional Marriage, even though as governor I was the first gay marriage governor in the country. And I think when it comes to foreign policy, well, all the way back to 2012, in his famous debate with President Obama, Romney said that we should understand Russia to be our chief geopolitical adversary, and I think people who lament his having been defeated in 2012, and I voted for him, but I don't lament his having been defeated, except in the sense that it means that Obama continued to be president, but I think people who kind of try to lionize him say, well, look, Romney was right. Russia is our chief geopolitical adversary. Those people have another name, and that is opponents of Trump, because Trump in the GOP primaries stood for the idea that we should reach some kind of accommodation with Russia, that we have common interests with Russia, like defeating ISIS and Islamic terrorism generally, and that intentionally ratcheting up tension with the Russians, as we've done since the Clinton administration, has been a mistake. So I actually favor Trump's position, and I don't know why he would appoint somebody to be Secretary of State whose chief claim to any foreign policy bona fides is that he's taken exactly the opposite position from Trump's position in regard to Russia. I think, then, that I don't see any reason why he'd want to appoint Romney. It seems, too, if your argument is, well, I'm a good idea for president because I'll drain the swamp. Who's more swampish than Mitt Romney? I think, you know, he's somebody's son and heir. That's why he became a politician in the first place. Then he's from Massachusetts. He's obviously, I think, clearly, transparently, a left-wing advocate when it comes to social issues. He's yet another Harvard. Have we had enough of them yet? And so, no, please, no, spare me. If I had to choose between Bolton, whom I definitely dislike, and Romney, I think that's a pretty easy choice. At least with Bolton, you know what you're getting, and I think Trump could discount what Bolton is saying in any private conversation about what to do about a foreign policy problem. On the other hand, you don't really ever know what Romney's thinking, so it's a terrible idea. Giuliani, well, remember him in the 2012 Republican debates arguing with Ron Paul about American interventionism.
Right.
But he's again, he's not a neocon in the sense that he's not a Mr. Nation Building, but definitely tending toward the John Bolton end of the Republican spectrum. Corker, not an interventionist. On the other hand, just author of the most flagrantly anti-constitutional procedural device to come from Republicans in the Senate in recent memory with this, we'll let the president do what he wants in regard to Iran unless we can find a supermajority in the Senate to vote against it. What the heck was that? So I don't like him as a senator, but it may be that reflected general hesitance to use military force, and obviously I favor that. So I guess Corker's better than the other three guys we've thought of, but surely there's got to be somebody who's a better choice than any of those people.
Well, his last name is Paul.
Yeah, well, he's not going to.
No.
Obviously.
No.
Senator Paul, I'm sure, is not interested in old man Paul's too old. And in fact, since 2012, I think he's kind of headed toward the crankish end of the pool with kind of blaming America for every kind of international problem. So,
well, you know, it's interesting. You say that old man Paul is too old. I added to the book Patrick Henry, American Statesman, and prepared it for modern readers. And one of the towards the end of the book, one of the chapters is where Washington gets the bright idea that he's trying to make amends with Patrick Henry. And so he invites him, or asks him to be Secretary of State, as I recall it.
Yeah.
And Henry has to decline because he says, not only can I not travel abroad, I can't even make it down to the end of the road.
Right. But, you know, Patrick Henry was in his 60s when he said that.
Yeah, he died very young, much too young. But then, didn't Billy Joel write us a song about that, Kevin?
Well, you know, there was a point at which... Catholics in America saw that as an anti-Catholic song, so there was a big uproar over it when it came out, because apparently he was decrying, or at least he was kind of tweaking Catholic sexual ethics here, you know. Dying young meant, well, you know what it meant.
Right.
So, I find the song somewhat amusing myself, but I wouldn't have thought you'd be recommending it. Let me put it that way.
I'm not recommending it. I just saw that he, just the title, that Only the Good Die Young.
There you go.
Now, continuing on, are you surprised, or is this Trump just being pragmatic by the selection of, by my count, and maybe you have a different count because I didn't really research it, but memory serves that with the appointment of the new Treasury Secretary, that this would make the fifth consecutive either CEO or high-ranking executive from Goldman Sachs to be appointed Treasury Secretary. I don't know if my count is right or not, but what do you think about that?
Let's see. There's Geithner. There's old man Rubin. Was Summers formerly at Goldman? I'm not sure.
But Paulson was, for sure.
Paulson, right. So there certainly have been at least three recent guys who were, and that this would make four. Maybe there's another one that I'm not thinking of. But, yeah, it strikes me as just, it must be evidence that there's not a lot of thought going into these selections. Well, who are we going to have for Treasury Secretary? I don't know. Well, who's retired from Goldman Sachs recently? Or you know. So it's akin to the apparent process of choosing Supreme Court nominees. Who can we put on the Supreme Court? Well, I don't know. Who's graduated from Harvard Law School lately?
Right.
So we end up with the scintillating intellects of Anthony Kennedy and John Roberts.
Well, did you mention Rubin? Did you count Rubin in that number?
Yeah.
Okay, so Rubin did. I'm pretty sure that Summers, in between his gigs at Harvard or Yale or wherever he was, that he was at Goldman Sachs. I don't think he was ever CEO, but I'm pretty
sure about that, maybe.
I had to look it up. But here's the key appointment that Kevin Gutzman fans or the world over want to know. Who is Trump going to get to replace Jonathan Gruber?
Well, yeah. Does he have an official position in the administration?
Or? I don't know. Does he?
You have to figure that when he's not meeting with that that fellow who was organizing the efforts that were exposed by Project Veritas, that probably Obama's still putting in the occasional phone call to Professor Gruber, because, hey, man, it's impossible to come up with all those lies yourself. You got to be relying on other people too. So, as far as who will be kind of backstage Svengali of Trump's efforts, well, it seems pretty clear that there are people he's going to rely on. I mean, I think it's pretty obvious he's going to rely on Kellyanne Conway.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I don't think is going to have one of the hot sounding titles, and she's made clear that she's going to continue to devote substantial time to her several very young kids.
Five.
Yeah, but I'm sure she's going to have something to do with the White House. So that's one person.
Yeah, Bannon, of course, Stephen K. Bannon.
Yeah, well, his name's already known.
Right.
We don't really know, you know. We don't really know who's running the Trump operation. But people kind of have the idea that Trump sits up late at night and tweets things out spontaneously. But if you think about the content of those tweets, the way they're targeted, I think it's pretty clear that there's substantial thought that goes into that, and I wouldn't be surprised if he had two or three advisors. Maybe Conway's involved in that. It's pretty clear that when he rips off one that says, I wouldn't mind deporting people who burn the American flag. This is intended to appeal to a certain part of his audience.
True.
And it works. He gets his chief opponents to go out and start burning flags, and this reminds people why they like Trump. So
I'd like to read something to you and get your thoughts on this. Now, this is in my fantasy world. This is what Donald Trump would say in the coming weeks or would already have said. I'll just read part of it. And this is after I read the WorldNet Daily and the Wall Street Journal detailed reviews or detailed listings of who was being nominated, who was rumored to be nominated, et cetera, et cetera. President Trump might say something to this effect, Professor Gutzman, quote, "Today I am announcing the closing of three cabinet-level federal agencies. These closings will take place over a period of 1 year as a task force is commissioned to distribute their duties to other federal agencies or back to the states where the 10th Amendment says they belong. I am not making these moves for any other reason than to begin the process of draining the swamp and restoring a constitutional order to our government. The agencies are the Departments of Energy, Education, Housing and Urban Development, the Department of Transportation, Commerce Department, Small Business Administration, and Department of Labor serve no function that can be carried out that cannot be carried out by the private sector or the state. So if they choose, I will therefore not be filling those cabinet positions. I am appointing Mitt Romney to be the chairperson of the task force that will oversee these changes. He will be assisted by Governor Bobby Jindal, who will act as liaison to the states." What do you think?
Well, it's a good start. Sure. You know, I think arguably there are 10 departments that could go without any substantial loss. So any progress that could be made in that direction would be something novel. And, of course, conservatives have been calling for this for generations, and nothing ever seems to happen. So if Trump eliminated even one substantial program, he would have one more such notch in his belt than George W. Bush racked up in 6 years of controlling the White House and the entire Congress.
That's right.
So, I think that kind of thing is actually going to happen, too. I don't know about so wide-ranging a program for doing that, but I would be surprised if we didn't see some substantial federal programs eliminated over the next 4 years, and won't that be a glorious consummation?
Well, it'll certainly be a change of pace in yours and my lifetime. The only thing that I can remember, two things that I can remember that even come close. One is the Base Closing Commission, 1992, I want to say, 93, somewhere up in there. And the second is, and you probably know more about this than I do because you worked up as an intern on the Hill for a little while, I seem to recall that President Reagan attempted something, as my little spiel there detailed, and he appointed something or concocted something called the Grace Commission. Do you recall either one of those two? You want to comment on that?
Well, the Grace Commission produced proposals for reforming federal spending, and essentially it was ignored. The only other substantial federal organization I can think of being eliminated in my lifetime was the Interstate Commerce Commission. That was created in the late 19th century and had to do with regulating railroads. And in the first place, at least, it later did other things, but it's now defunct. So there's that. But I think, as you and I have discussed, many of the agencies of the federal government no longer have raison d'etre, right? They don't have the original reasons for existing, and there have been none to replace them. So, for example, I've pointed out here many times, the NASA was created by John Kennedy to get a man to the moon by 1969. Well, it did. So now it still exists. Why? Well, in my lifetime, there have been, to my recollection, at least four administrations in which the NASA administrator announced that he was going to be defining a new mission for NASA. There has been no new mission for NASA, but NASA continues to spend nearly $20 billion a year. Now, I will grant that that's less than it spent in the 80s.
Right, right.
So that's something, but NASA shouldn't exist. If there's going to be space exploration, let it be privately financed. The Commerce Department it spends nearly $30 billion a year and benefits accrue chiefly to three major corporations.
Wow.
Yeah. So let's get rid of that. The Department of Education, well, the person he's appointing to be the Secretary of Education actually has been one of the prime movers of one of the main education reform initiatives in the country these last three decades. So maybe she's going to use the bully pulpit and her administrative powers there to push for charter schools to become more common. But
and who is that, Kevin?
Her name is DeVos, D-E-V-O-S.
Okay.
Yeah, so,
I didn't see that one. Okay, DeVos.
Yeah, so that's a good thing, but I think it could be done without there being a Department of Education.
Ditto that.
And I would still like to see the elimination of the Department of Education. And then there, of course, there are the various welfare agencies like the Department of Agriculture, whose purpose is to make sure that our food prices don't fall too low. Yes, that's right. It exists to keep food prices high. I'd rather not have that. And I don't think a politician could actually justify that beyond saying, well, people in various Midwestern states are going to vote to have it exist because they like being the recipients of this largesse from the federal government, and so on. Now, as far as the more important question, theoretically, of course, virtually all of these things that I've been discussing are, at least in major part, if not entirely, unconstitutional. That's one reason why they shouldn't exist, and it's one reason why somebody who takes the oath of office as president should think, well, one of my jobs is to make these things cease to exist. And you know, another example of this is the public broadcasting system. Why does that need to exist? The original argument for it was, well, people need to have access to the arts, and if you live in Bismarck or you know, Tupelo or whatever, you don't have the New York Philharmonic, so we'll put it on television. But now, if you live in Bismarck or Tupelo, just like people in the rest of the country, you have 120 channels. So there's no reason to have PBS.
Yeah, smartphones, too.
Yeah, so PBS should cease to exist, or at least it should cease to be funded by the federal government. And we could go through, you know, three dozen other federal programs that would come to mind immediately and say the same thing. There's always the hope that this kind of thing will be done. It would save money at a time when the federal government is just buried under debt. But you can't be that hopeful about it because, well, Paul Ryan and the boys would have to cooperate, and we know that Paul Ryan stands for never reducing spending in any way.
This is true. This is definitely true.
Yeah.
This is the Constitution Hour with Professor Dr. Kevin Gutzman here on the Crusade Channel, part of the Veritas Radio Network, radio the way it should be. why don't we switch gears for just a moment and go back to the Electoral College and this latest controversy that has been manufactured by Green Party candidate Jill Stein, who has absolutely no chance, 0.0 chance, not only of becoming president, but of even scoring an electoral vote in the state of Wisconsin, where she is challenging for a recount. It seems to me that this is just a very flimsily or very hastily cobbled together and not very well disguised attempt to keep some Democrat Party apparatchiks employed until Christmas so they can go shopping.
Well, who knows what the heck it's about. You know, if you're Jill Stein, one thing you're getting out of it is a mailing list.
And that's true.
And it's one of the chief political assets in America today is a list of people who are willing to give money to your cause. So she is expanding the Green Party mailing list to an extent that she couldn't have imagined without this. So there is every incentive for that to happen. From her point of view. On the other hand, it's possible, as Limbaugh is speculating these days, that really the Clinton campaign is behind the Green Party requests for recounts, and that they're doing it because they want to throw doubt upon the legitimacy of Trump's election. And I never put anything past the Clintons.
Nope.
So that's a possibility. But in any event, I am 98% confident that nothing will come of it. Of course, I was 70-80% confident that Hillary Clinton would be elected. So my confidence isn't much of an indicator.
Well, we'll it's difficult sledding, shall we say, trying to predict the outcomes of democratically based elections. So not many people would or thought that Trump was going to be elected. And the only reason I guessed, or that, and I did kind of guess, was I just, I could not bring myself to say President Hillary Clinton. And so I couldn't deal with the reality that she was going to be president. Anyways, it worked out that way. Well, let me talk for just a minute here about the Electoral College, because it remains under assault. There are now people burning flags in the streets of New York, and heaven knows, middle schoolers, fifth graders are now being told to walk out of class and stand in the middle of a playground and shout Never Trump and all these other insanities here. And we still have this, well, what we ought to do is we ought to have the popular vote ought to count, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's fascinating reading, but I went through and did it anyways. Volume 2 of Max Farren's Records of the Federal Convention, 1787. From July the 19th to July 25th, 1787, there was a 5 or 6 day long debate over how to phrase or how to choose the president. And, you know, when I talked to you, your colleague, Tom Woods, yesterday on the show, I told him, I said, I had not read that in its entirety before. I said, but it's really fascinating. They were very they were mortified over the process of how to elect the president. First of all, they couldn't decide on the title. Our chief magistrate was one. Chief executive was another. No one, it seems, chief executive was the prevailing one. I didn't see president in there. And if I did, maybe I just didn't. I didn't recognize it. So in any event, as I was going through these 5 days of debates, hey, awful lot of thought went into this. And so much so, Kevin, it's really quite remarkable that 5-6 days worth of debate and votes and then edits produced the following. The House of Representatives shall be composed of members chosen every second year by the people of the several states, and the electors in each state shall have the qualifications requisite for electors of the most numerous branch of the state legislature. My point would be, and you're the expert on this, this was not something that was just arbitrarily decided or cobbled together in a fit of desperation in the convention in Philadelphia, was it?
No, it wasn't. It was an issue that divided the convention. They had, as you say, extensive discussion of it, apparently not only on the record, but after hours. And there were contending interests at stake. People like James Wilson from Pennsylvania wanted to have a national popular vote for president. Others, like Elbridge Gerry of Massachusetts, insisted that this was a bad idea, among other things, because the average voter wouldn't be well enough informed about politicians from other regions of the country than his own to make a decision among them. And I think that's proven to be very well forecast. And besides that, there was a question of, in case voting were by state instead of on a bare popular basis, how the voting would be apportioned. And so ultimately the small states won a victory when, instead of having just each state have the weight that it had in the House of Representatives and the Electoral College, they decided to make the number of electors equal each state's senators plus representatives, so that essentially the smaller states are overrepresented, or they thought of it as they were protected against the domination of the three large states, Pennsylvania, Massachusetts, and Virginia at the time. We can see by looking at a map of the way the election turned out this year that forecast is still well-founded. I mean,
yep.
Essentially, Donald Trump won the popular vote by 2 million votes in 49 states and then got completely swamped in California. So, the version of presidential elections that we have now ends up being a federal one instead of a national one, because Wilson's proposal was rejected. So what we have is a federal system in which a federal chief executive is chosen. That is, he's not the product of a popular vote, but instead of each state's considered vote as a unit, as a sovereign political community. And it seems to me that the federal element is desirable in itself, but so is not having a bare local majority. If you contemplate the possibility of a popular vote selection of the president, you'll soon recognize that campaigning for president would work entirely differently from the way it does now. People nowadays, for example, Trump's answer to people's pointing out that if you tally all the popular votes, Mrs. Clinton had more than Trump. Trump's answer was, well, of course she did. I didn't campaign in California at all. I didn't run any ads. I didn't have any rallies. I didn't do anything there. I just wrote it off because I knew I'd lose in California. If we were having a popular vote, then I would have campaigned in California. I would have gotten more votes in California. She would have had fewer. That's a symptom of the way a national popular vote would work. You'd also have, of course, Trump campaigning in New York and Texas and Florida, and essentially the four or five most populous states would receive all the attention, and the other states would receive no attention at all. There wouldn't be popular caucuses in Iowa where people had to talk to, where candidates had to talk to individuals about local concerns and that kind of thing. I think it would... For reasons that were foreseen in Philadelphia and for reasons that weren't, a national popular vote would be a worse method of choosing the president.
Yeah, I concur. And on one of his final comments in the debate, the subject of your book, James Madison and the Making of America, makes the signal point that the answer to this objection, which was that the little states are going to get hoodwinked here and aren't going to have enough representation, was that this disproportion would be continually decreasing under the influence of the Republican laws introduced in the southern states and the more rapid increase of their population. So he thought the southern population was going to grow, and that did happen, but it didn't keep up with the immigration into the north. And number two, that and this is what I found interesting about this, that local considerations must give way to the general interest. As an individual from the southern states, he was willing to make the sacrifice. That was kind of the torture James Madison that you wrote so eloquently of, that he was a Federalist, but he did see instances in which, well, you know what, guys, you're just not going to get your way in your little locale. You're going to have to, the needs, he was channeling Mr. Spock from Star Trek 200 years in advance. The needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few.
Madison certainly thought that the small states were getting more than they should be getting in the final version of the Constitution.
Yeah, I think that's apparent.
he believed that there should be population apportionment of the Senate, and he thought that senators should be elected by the lower house instead of being elected by state legislators. And in general, he didn't like the final form of the Constitution, as I make clear in James Madison, The Making of America. This is why I say that he shouldn't be thought of, and in fact, he himself insisted that he not be thought of as father of the Constitution. But he's just mistaken. I mean, he's wrong to think that having a national popular vote would be preferable. Of course, his stated reason for insisting on a national popular vote and for population apportionment, mm-hmm. well, it's required by the Republican principle. If every citizen is equal, then they should all have equal weight in this election process. Here we see him not seeing the advantage of the federal principle. And this is why I say later on in the book, you know, when he looked back on his career, Madison wanted to believe he'd been a Jeffersonian even when he hadn't. That's a good example.
Yeah, and just to resolve the issue, if we go all the way to the end, it was a proposal that was made by Pinckney that ultimately led into the passage that I read from you. And here's Madison's comments from his own note. Mr. Gerry approved of Mr. Pinckney's motion as lessening the evil. And I thought as I read that they recognized that they were kind of playing with fire with a president. and that there was a lot of danger in this new system. And of course, you wrote the book on this, folks. If you want a great read on this subject and on anything that James Madison was involved in his professional life, then get a copy of Kevin Gutzman's James Madison of the Making and the Making of America, available at fine booksellers everywhere, including in our own Founders Trading Post. And of course, let's just talk for a minute. Let's give the new book a plug. The Thomas Jefferson Revolutionary, coming out near the end of January. Is that still our target date?
Yep, January 31.
January 31st, and this is a volume you spent, what, three years on Madison? How long on Jefferson?
Well, it's kind of like Madison in the sense that I've been thinking about these questions that I discuss in the book for decades, but the actual writing of the book took just over 2 years.
Just over 2 years. Well, I certainly look forward to getting my advance review copy. So just so I could say that I have something that nobody else has. Moving on now here on the Constitution Hour, featuring Professor Dr. Kevin Gutzman. There is now the possibility that there could be formal, very formal relations with the island nation of Cuba. Now that Fidel Castro has become metaphysically challenged, and that his brother Raul is basically incapacitated. Of course, this would necessitate some political changes in the Cuban government. But one thing that most Americans don't know, and it's because we never saw it in our lifetimes, is that prior to the Cuban embargo or to the Castro Revolution in the late 1950s, the island nation of Cuban, and you have to remember this is before it was very popular to perform international air travel, that the island nation of Cuba was the number one tourist destination for Americans who wanted to go, you know, a little bit abroad to some place that was exotic and take a vacation. You know, Havana was populated by nightclubs and casinos and all manner of entertaining spots. And it was a favorite place for a lot of Americans to go. So there is some familiarity between the Cuban people, I guess that we could revert back to, between the Cuban people and the people of the United States. Do you think this is one of the things that a Trump administration might pursue?
My understanding is that Trump is entirely unhappy with Obama's accommodation with the Castro brothers, and Rince Priebus has already warned that absent some quid for the quo here,
right?
that we're going to kind of walk back the steps Obama took. Essentially, what Obama did was similar to what he had done in relation to Iran. He gave the Cubans what they wanted and got nothing in return. He also apologized, which was really kind of crazy. I mean, one element of what Obama said in public in justification of his Cuban démarche was, well, you know, we've had the same policy for 50 years and it's been failing, so it's time to change it. But this is false. Granted, one element of the embargo policy was the hope that it would displace the Castro brothers. But another reason for the embargo policy was to deny resources to the Castro regime that it could have used in fomenting communist revolution. And so we have to ask ourselves, well, did having less money mean that Fidel Castro was not able to try to spread communism as he would have done if he had had more money? Even as things were, he supported communist revolution in El Salvador and Nicaragua and Angola, in a couple of South American countries, and I have no reason to doubt that if he had had more resources, he would have done more of that kind of thing. We ultimately won the Cold War, and so the policy was successful. And today there aren't any communist regimes on the mainland of the Americas. So it's just mistaken to say that our policy was unsuccessful. But, of course, that's what we expect from Obama. He next thing he'll be apologizing for is that we have elections in America.
You know, in one of the debates in 2012, Ron Paul was famously asked, what would you do if you were in the White House and Fidel Castro called? And Ron Paul said, I'd answer the phone.
Well, sure, you'd answer the phone. But you know, again, the thing is, what about the Iran deal? Well, you might want to have less strained relations with Iran, but whose fault is it that we have strained relations with Iran? And to say, okay, we hope that you're going to behave differently, but right here up front, we're going to give you $153 billion, seems to me rather foolish. If you want a horse to walk down the path, what do? You put the carrot in front of it. You don't say, all right, first you eat the carrot, and then we'll go for a ride. That's not a very good plan.
Again, we're even going to give you some ranch dressing dipping sauce. So, wait a minute. This special Obamacare offer, you don't just get the carrot. Speaking of Obamacare, one of the appointments that we did not cover, and I just wanted to go back to this because I was going through the notes that I have here, and that is, I believe it's Congressman Tom Price, or Dr. Tom Price, is going to HHS, right?
Yes, so I understand. And there's another cabinet department that shouldn't exist, but
yes.
Yeah, that's what I understand.
I actually interviewed Dr. Price one time back on the old station in the old country as the new, I guess it was the Boehner regime was coming in 2010. And he said all the right things about repealing Obamacare, but as you and I know, there were, 40-some-odd efforts, I think, to actually get rid of or to...
No, over 50, and actually they passed them. They passed them. And one time through the House, and one time they passed a bill to repeal the law, but of course the president vetoed it. So we know that there's every reason to think that the statute will be repealed. One problem, though, is that, as is typical of them, the Republicans have identified two elements of the Obamacare statute that people find appealing and decided to keep them. Of course, they are the costly parts of the statute. One of them is a mandate that health insurance companies allow dependents to stay on their parents' health insurance plans until they reach the age of 26.
Right, right.
Now, I think this is nonsensical. I am the father of three, and one's going to be 20 within a couple of weeks. One's 18 and one's 16, and there's no reason to think that they should be on my health insurance until they're 26. Why is that necessary? Go out and get a job and get your own health insurance. So now, though, of course, everybody who buys health insurance in America is paying for other people's kids to be on until they're 26. This means that every health insurance plan in America is more expensive than it was before, and, of course, is supposed to prod us toward favoring single-payer health care. I think that provision should be repealed.
Absolutely.
To retain that. And then the other one is this so-called pre-existing condition insurance. But this is, of course, nonsense, the idea of pre-existing condition insurance. Imagine your house were on fire and you called the insurance company and say, I'd like fire insurance. I have a pre-existing condition. That's not insurance. You're just saying, I want a transfer of money from you to me.
That's right.
So if the federal government or the state government, of course, it's all unconstitutional at the federal level, but if the state government wants to say, you know, if your child is the one in 380,000 who has some obscure disease, our state insurance plan for poor people will cover your kid, that sounds to me like a perfectly reasonable thing for a state government to do. I actually would probably favor that. That's one of the few things I would favor having government do. But for the federal government to be in this business,
not so much.
And to do it by saying, you know, we're going to force insurance companies to fund it. Also, it's nothing but a transfer of wealth from insurance companies to these unfortunate people who are in that situation. Really, the money shouldn't be coming out of the pockets of the insurance companies. It should be done. This is something that should be done by state governments.
Now,
or by charities.
I was going to throw the philanthropy in. One point on this that I think you and I have discussed this one time back in 2010 when this was all before the this was still pending in front of the Congress, and it had not been the deals had not been made, and it had not yet final approval had not been attained. And that's this a proper understanding of the now infamous regulating commerce clause. Congress actually could have a constitutional role in making medical insurance commerce regular between the states, couldn't they?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure. They could do what they do in connection with other kinds of commerce among the states. They could say that interstate sale has to be allowed. They could they could ensure that states weren't setting up restrictions purportedly for the good of consumers, but really to ensure that there wouldn't be interstate competition
right.
in other areas. Yeah, so this is a legitimate role of Congress, right? That's what the Commerce Clause is supposed to be for. The Commerce Clause is not supposed to be for borrowing money and giving it to voters. It's supposed to be for ensuring that people can buy things from people in other states. Yes.
Right. And I always thought that if we could just get some members of Congress, because I don't even think they know this, if you could just get a couple of advocates, it's common. It makes, when you said that just now, I went, that makes perfect common sense. That actually sounds like it would work. And it doesn't sound like it would require all manner of details. It just sounds like, oh, okay. Yeah, that's what they should do. I just wanted to throw that in. Time is running short, and there's a couple of other issues that the professor wishes to get to here today. We have new polls in the for the French presidential election. And are we going to talk about Marie Le Pen? And is Marie Le Pen, is she the French version of Donald Trump?
Well, I do think we have this general trend in the West today of voting out establishments. We saw it in Brexit. Apparently it's happening, or it very nearly happened in the Austrian presidential election. It looks as if Le Pen is going to make more noise in the French presidential election than before, and there are other European countries where people are voting for the kind of the anti-establishment candidate. But this Le Pen candidacy is an illustration of the fact that we don't want to confuse the American right with whatever anti-establishment person may be popular in some European country.
Right.
Marine Le Pen is beyond the pale as far as American politics are concerned. She is the heiress of her father, who started the Front National, which is the party that she heads now, and he was an odious character who liked to say really just, you know, denial verging things about the Holocaust and make other anti-Semitic comments and say negative things about Arabs on a racial basis and so on. He is not a person that American conservatives would find acceptable. And his daughter has distanced herself from him somewhat. In fact, apparently, at least publicly, the two of them are kind of incommunicado with each other nowadays. But I don't think we would want to think of Le Pen victory in France as being something that we would be really happy about. It would be a manifestation of the general trend of Brexit and Trump, but it's not the same kind of animal. On the other hand, you know, Nigel Farage is very happy with the Trump win, and I think we can see Brexit as being related to the Trump win.
Yeah, and some people had even joked that maybe Trump can nominate Nigel Farage to a position, there is something in the Constitution about foreign. I can't remember what clause it is, but he couldn't, as not being an American citizen, he could not hold a position. Correct.
I'm not familiar with that.
Yeah, you see,
maybe there's a statute. The only thing I know in that regard that's actually in the Constitution are residency requirements for holding the elected offices.
Right.
There's on the other side of the coin, there's the Emoluments Clause, which says that high American officials aren't supposed to take major prizes from foreign governments or, you know, take big gifts or that kind of thing. So I don't think if Trump had Farage as, say, a private advisor, that would violate any kind of American policy. But I've read that that Farage is thinking about immigrating to the United States. So,
oh, he's been here enough times. He knows us well enough.
Right. So that's possible. But I don't know. It'll be interesting. He's very quick on his feet. He's a very interesting fellow. Unlike Le Pen, he's the kind of guy that we endorse.
And then you had in your notes here about presidential polls in the European, et cetera, in the EU. There's some interesting developments that are going on in the old country. For example, 4 years ago, the Protestants and the Catholics in Hungary buried the hatchet, wrote a new constitution. put what I call a God clause in it, basically outlawed abortion by definition and some other things. Now we see what's going on in Poland, and we see that Poland is actually, I don't know if you want to say leaping, inching, creeping, rolling back towards some of their ancien regime positions when they were a member of what you and I would call historically is Christendom. My friend Joseph Pierce says that, well, these things go in cycles, and he thinks that the turn is now away from the democratic efforts that overtook and replaced all the sovereignties, the kings and the dukes and all that. You're a bit of a whiz when it comes to world history as well. What do you think?
Well, yeah, one of my outside fields in my PhD study at UVA was Russian history.
Okay.
I think you left out
Austria, right?
Actually, one interesting fact about Hungary is you think of it as being a Catholic country because it was part of the Habsburg Empire, but actually most people in Hungary are Calvinist Protestants.
Right, right.
Yeah. Well, I think clearly people who live in Eastern Europe are going through a kind of religious renaissance, if that pair of words can be joined together. Poland recently adopted a law that banned all abortions, period.
That's right.
And in fact, since the end of communism, public schools have had crucifixes on the wall in every room, and the same kind of phenomenon has been evident in Romania, where there are now thousands of Romanian Orthodox monks.
That's good.
In Russia, they have reopened churches all over the country, and
yep.
the government is strongly supportive of Russian Orthodoxy once again. So it's an interesting thing. Hungary actually also, its prime minister is one of these people who are in the same line as Farage and Trump, and he said repeatedly that he will not accept any Middle Eastern refugees.
Sure.
So while Germany has been swamped with over a million of essentially young male Islamist types, and this has had negative consequences for Chancellor Merkel in terms of her popularity among German voters. And we have to remember that there are only 80 million people in Germany. So taking 1.5 million young male Muslims from Syria who are completely unvetted is akin to taking in 6 or 7 million people in the United States. Just, it's astounding. Right across the street, as it were, the Hungarians have said, we are taking zero. And this has put them in bad odor with the European Union, but of course made them popular with people like Farage. And there's similar political noise in the Netherlands, where Geert Wilders' party apparently stands a good chance of taking control of parliament. And he's got the same kind of position on these questions as the ruling party in Hungary has. So, in other words, there's kind of backlash to the open borders argument and the violence that's been seen in several European countries that
right.
spurred that. I think, though, there are some countries in Europe where it remains a kind of question of faith that you're not supposed to criticize. Not only Mrs. Merkel in Germany, but also the Swedes have taken in such a gigantic number of immigrants in relation to their own population that within 30 or 40 years, Sweden is going to be a majority Muslim country.
Yes, they are. That's if the Muslims stay there. It's rather cold. Final question. I did not know about your PhD in Russian history.
Well, my PhD is in American history, but
you're minor.
One part of getting a PhD in American history at the University of Virginia is that when you take your comprehensive examination, you have to have an outside field, and my outside U.S. field was Russia.
Fascinating. So I give you 30 seconds to answer this, and we can pick it up on another episode. If you had to make an inquiry or study, as you had with James Madison and Thomas Jefferson, is there someone in Russia or in Russian history that you would choose?
Well, the most interesting modern character, of course, is the Tsar Reformer at the time, in the middle of the 19th century, Alexander II. He's the one who instituted local elections for town councils, trial by jury, the various reforms in that direction. He intended to modernize Russia's political society, and so, of course, anarchists assassinated him. And, but he's seen as a martyr by the Russian Orthodox Church, and clearly there were people in the Romanov family who thought that Russia needed to have democratic reforms, and that's the direction he was going. So he's really interesting. Another one is Nicholas the First. Nicholas the First at the beginning of the 19th century. You have Alexander the First, and then his brother succeeded him through the middle of the 19th century. And he's interesting because of his great devoutness. So he understood that being the emperor was a burden that had been put on him by God, and he, by all accounts, was extremely attentive to his duties. He's a very interesting fellow, too.
Fantastic. Well, Kevin, what a great show today. Thank you. You know what? You and I should do a sidebar one day and have a discussion about these figures in Russia, because it sounds like they parallel some of the experiences that we have here. Folks, that's all the time we have for this edition of the Constitution Hour with Professor Dr. Kevin Gutzman. If you missed any of the previous episodes, download any or all of them at VeritasRadioNetwork.com. It's Mike Church saying so long here from the Crusade Channel, part of the Veritas Radio Network, radio the way it should be.